Todd Feinberg here. We are going to be joined right now by an After Six guest who's on all the time, but we don't expose him early in the show very often, and I feel guilty about not getting him on the air for you. So here he is right now, Michael Leibowitz. He's a prisoner in the state prison system, and he appears regularly with us, but always during the 6 o'clock hour, so this is a little treat. Michael, welcome to WTIC once again.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Give people a quick profile on you and how you got to be at this point in your life, 22 years an inmate in the state prison system.
Well, when I was 21 years old, actually between 19 and 21, I committed a series of offenses that culminated in I had three of my friends break into my ex-girlfriend's house and stab her boyfriend, and I received a 27-year sentence for that to run consecutive, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds, with a 6-year sentence I was doing for a total sentence of 33 years, and I've been in since. That was in 1997. And since I've been in jail, I've done a lot of reading, a lot of thinking, and a lot of changing.
All right, and that's the fun part, I think, for us, is to get to know you now. And getting to know you now is fascinating all by itself, but when you put it in the context of what you, where you are calling us from and how long you've been there and what you did to get there, it makes it all the more remarkable. So we're going to talk about a plan you've developed to reduce criminal activity, to reduce crime. Is that right?
To reduce crime and ultimately reduce the prison population, or what's been called mass incarceration.
All right. Tell us about how simple changes. I'm assuming you've got a really simple plan that's obvious, that would reduce crime. Tell us about it.
Well, I don't know how simple or obvious it is. Otherwise, they would have already done it. I just have to tell you that it's real loud here in the Hooskow, so if I have trouble hearing you, I apologize.
No, that's good. Just, it adds to the ambiance, the effect of the whole thing. So, just like the beeps on the phone line to remind us, every time it beeps, it reminds us that you're institutionalized.
Yeah, some authentic prison life. Okay,
exactly.
So the first part of my plan is to end the war on drugs. Get rid of it. It's a failure. Now, in a previous interview, I went over some of the moral reasons to end it, but ultimately, for this purpose, I think it would reduce crime, not all crime, but a significant amount of it, because there are those drug addicts who commit crimes simply to feed their drug habit, because they can't afford it, whereas if it were legal, they would be able to afford it, and they'd be functioning heroin and coke addicts like you have your functioning alcoholic. And it would also put an end to gang violence around drugs.
Now, it's interesting about, just in terms of thinking about crime stats, and that it's really a liberty issue, too. There's no reason why a lot of drugs should be illegal except a desire on the part of the federal government to grow bigger and to, once they start something like the quote-unquote war on drugs, there's a ton of machinery there that is financed and institutionalized by the federal government, and a lot of people make money off of that and would fight to keep everything the same. And I think when people talk about things being rigged in America and feeling that it's not all that democratic anymore, part of the reason it's not so democratic is because of this huge federal government and all the money it pumps into things that maybe people don't think are useful but are immovable objects. And I feel like that's what the war on drugs is.
I agree. I think it is immoral, highly. I think that drugs should be legal for that reason. I think it is a bloated federal government not minding its business. But I also think that the practical effects would be to reduce crime substantially. As far as gang wars, shooting it out and arresting people for simple possession of drugs. Now, obviously, people that are into making a lot of money on drugs aren't going to all of a sudden go legit any more than the mafia went legit when Prohibition ended. But I do think it would make a significant dent in the crime problem.
Okay, so that's one prong of your reduced crime approach. What else?
Okay, so the next prong is, within the prison systems, they should implement widely what are known as evidence-based programming. These are programs that have been shown to reduce recidivism significantly when they're implemented properly.
Evidence-based programs, is that what you call it?
Evidence-based programs, yes.
Okay, and just for people who are new to listening to you and prison talk, programs are classes and courses that are taught to prisoners while incarcerated, right?
Yes, and most of them are useless, but there are certain programs that have been shown to significantly reduce recidivism and to reform offenders.
Like what? What has been proven to reduce recidivism?
Well, first you have to start with the idea of assessment, and you have to assess the needs of the prisoner. You know, is he high risk, low risk? Does he have an education, not an education? That sort of thing. And when applied to high-risk offenders who have what they call criminogenic needs, and criminogenic needs are things like attitudes, values, behaviors that are antisocial in nature and also antisocial friends, drug use, that sort of thing. So you address those aspects of the offender with cognitive behavioral therapy, which is essentially you teach the offender how to think differently by telling him how his thinking is maladaptive, but you also model appropriate behaviors for him to see and punish bad behavior and reward good behavior.
Oh, it's so funny you mentioned this. I've been meaning to tell you. I read this quote from Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
And it was basically, I don't understand why people go through life having a negative self-destructive narrative in their heads when there's millions of positive narratives you could choose instead.
That's a good quote from a guy who was a convict himself.
Yeah, oh, that's right. He did time in Folsom Prison, didn't he?
He escaped from prison, I believe, yeah.
But I love that idea of narratives. It's really interesting how narratives are part of the narrative today. But the idea that we are a result, our lives are a result of our attitude towards life to a large extent, and that those attitudes are, there's a certain randomness to them. You know, maybe we inherit our internal narrative from a parent, or maybe we have a tragedy in our life that scars us, and that's where we draw our narrative from. And really, if you can retrain your brain, you can have different outcomes in your life. So you're suggesting that there are successful programs that allow a prisoner, teach a prisoner, to adopt a different set of reactions to his circumstances, right?
Yeah, basically a new worldview.
And how would that, did you take that class?
I haven't taken any of those classes, but I've read a significant amount about them.
And how's it work? What can you tell us about it?
Well, there's different ideas, but basically, in the course of a group, you would expose the criminal's thinking patterns. Like, you would ask him maybe a series of questions. So through his answers, like, you may ask me, you know, what do you do on a daily basis? And I would say, hypothetically, this is not what I really do, but I would say, well, you know, I play dominoes, I watch television, I listen to music, I get angry sometimes when guys disrespect me, and so you would listen to that sort of language. So you might pick up, say, on that word disrespect, and you might say, okay, well, what constitutes disrespect and why does it matter? So I might say, well, a guy cut me in line, and then you might say, okay, well, what were your thoughts as that happened? And I would say, well, I'm thinking this guy doesn't respect me, he doesn't like me, he thinks he can push me around. If he does it, then everybody else is going to think they can do it. And then you can expose the errors in that way of thinking. Like, for instance, you may teach me to not care what people think about me. Like, it's not important what these people, their opinion is of me. And the fact that he cut in front of me doesn't mean he's disrespecting me personally. It may just be that's what he does without having me in mind at all. And the chances are everybody else is paying attention to their own thing, not to just this guy cutting in front of me.
Right, so you're personalizing
a more accurate way to think. You're
personalizing a behavior that might not be directed at you at all. And
yes,
in the scheme of the other person's perspective, might be infinitesimal while you're viewing it as big and deliberate.
Yeah, or like another thing might be somebody might say, I have to sell drugs because I have to make fast money. So you would point out to the offender, well, okay, true, you're going to make fast money, but then how much of that money are you spending on lawyers, on bail, on commissary, on phone calls? In the end, you're losing. You're not really making fast money, although it might appear that you are. So you would help to correct that flawed thinking. And then also, like I said, you'd have to model responsible behavior and also reinforce him when he does good things and punish him when he does bad things.
Yeah, that's great. I love that idea that you could retrain those kinds of reactions.
Yeah. Now, the next part of the program is what they call core correctional practices. Now, the importance of this is that if you send an offender to a group where he's taught to take responsibility for his life, be pro-social, do the right thing, and then send them immediately back to an environment where bad behavior is rewarded, good behavior is punished, the COs model bad behavior, they're swearing, they're gambling, they're doing all types of stuff they shouldn't be doing, the lessons in group are likely to go out the window. So what we need are correctional officers and other staff who are going to enforce smart rules in a firm, fair, and consistent manner to demonstrate to the offender that if you behave correctly, you're going to have success in life. But if you behave incorrectly...
You have 1 minute left.
And by doing that over and over again, the offender comes to learn that there is a better way, and his way is not going to work.
All right, but so, this would require, as you've indicated, there's a certain lack of cohesiveness in terms of how staff perform and the messages that they give off about what's supposed to go on in the atmosphere, and maybe we can talk about that. So let's take this opportunity to grab a quick break. Michael's got to dial back in, and we will continue coming up on WTIC. Continuing our conversation with Michael Leibowitz, he's a prisoner in the state prison system, 22 years there, and he joins us usually on After 6, but we're doing this early time so that more people can get to know Michael and to feel some affinity for him, I think. That's my goal, because I think this provides us a really interesting entree into the whole prison reform movement and the conversation about what policies are the right ones for the state to follow. So Mike is going through his ideas for how to reduce crime, and we left off talking about prison guards and how their messaging to prisoners is important. But fill us in a little more on how that's important. How are prisoners affected by what guards have to say to them?
It's actually in many ways, but one of them is if inmates see staff misbehaving, breaking the rule, doing what they're not supposed to do, then it reinforces the idea that everybody's a crook, that nobody does what they're supposed to do, that we were just unlucky enough to get caught, which is never a message you want to send to a criminal. But it also makes it hard to know what to do. When you're punished sometimes for doing the right thing, rewarded for doing the wrong thing, when some rules are enforced, some aren't, it makes it very difficult to know what to do on any given day. And it makes taking the, I don't want to say easy road, but it makes taking the wrong road more appealing.
Yeah, so it occurred to me when you were saying this, Mike, that it might make sense. One model for a prison might be to have a very strict, tough love kind of treatment of prisoners, where there are rules, there's a tight organization, but it's a very positive, reinforcing one. You do well, you follow the rules, and you learn, and you study, and you advance yourself, then there are benefits from the system accruing to you. And it gives maybe people an incentive to change these patterns that you're talking about.
You're spot on. I'm starting to think maybe you don't need me at all here.
Well, I think I do.
But yeah, but the problem is with what we're talking about is the incentives. Because right now, they get paid, the COs, the staff, regardless of outcome. I've heard you mention quite often that there's currently a 60% three-year recidivist rate in the state. That's a failure. If a business had a 60% failure rate on their products, they'd go out of business. But the staff here know they're going to get paid no matter what. And they also have a very strong union. So I'm sure your listeners could understand why a unionized government organization would fail in its mission. I mean, that's not a secret. It's not a shock to anybody that that's what happens. The question is, how do we turn that around? And Brett McCall and I, and I'll get to that in a minute, but we came up with an idea a while back that staff should be remunerated. They should get paid based on the results they get for keeping the prison safe, for keeping the inmates safe, for preventing escapes, and for rehabilitating offenders. Those should be the metrics by which they're paid. Now, after Brent and I came up with that idea, I found out that it wasn't a unique idea at all. There was actually a private prison company called Serco that does that. Now, people get are averse to private prisons because in America, private prisons, as far as I know, are paid on a per inmate per bed basis. So basically, not per bed, per day, I'm sorry. Basically, they get paid for how many inmates they house. So there's really no incentive there in our private prisons to turn things around. Now, if they know that their jobs, their mortgage, their rent, whatever, depend on turning inmates around, then I think their behavior would vastly change. And it seems to be doing so from everything I've read about this Serco company, that their prisons in Australia, New Zealand, and I believe Scotland are actually having good results and have actually been praised by people who normally wouldn't praise private systems.
Yeah, so our government now tends to be a money-driven, greed-based governmental system. That is, if they can solidify their power, the people in elected positions and in the bureaucracy, if they can enhance their own power by giving contracts out to certain companies, that tends to be how it works. It's a rigged system, as opposed to there being a mission-based approach. How do we make better prisons? How do we make them more successful? And as a result of this, I think we maybe are squandering the opportunity of private prisons, that those prisons are companies that are not providing better incentives to their employees, that aren't reinventing the way prison is done, but are maybe making it worse or doing the same things wrong that the public prisons are doing.
Right on.
Okay, so what else is on your list, Michael Leibowitz, on how to reduce crime, or what else do you want to say on this particular aspect?
Okay, what I actually forgot, it comes earlier, is that I would like to see widely implemented for juveniles multisystemic therapy and functional family therapy. Multisystemic therapy is for high-risk juvenile delinquents, functional family therapy, less so. Those are two, basically, they're evidence-based programs like we discussed for the adults in the prison system, except for they're for juveniles who are out on the, you know, out in the street on probation or juvenile parole or however that works or what have you. And these programs are highly intrusive. They get involved in the whole family. They get involved, they teach the parents a new way to parent, they get involved in the school system, the community, and they have a very high success rate as far as reducing recidivism. So I think that should also be part of any plan. But if the kids have these opportunities and they continue to offend, they need to know that they're going to be held accountable.
Yep.
They need to know that they will be incarcerated in a juvenile detention facility that still offers them opportunities for rehabilitation, but they just have to know that they will lose their liberty if they continue to violate the rights of other people.
Well, you allude to a need for revamping that is based on pursuing excellence, pursuing success, and using positive incentives instead of perverse incentives in order to realign the way things are going. And that's hard to do when control over how the system operates has been kidnapped by this politician-union relationship that's more important than results.
Yes, which actually brings me to the last two things I want to say. The last part of my program is actually to have this privately funded as much as possible. There's plenty of famous, rich philanthropists, such as the Koch brothers, George Soros, Richard Branson, who have an interest in reducing mass incarceration. So if people like that would put their money where their mouths are, and I'm sure they already do, I'm not trying to insinuate they don't, but in regard to this issue, then a large portion of it could be privately funded, and then we wouldn't have the incessant debates about should taxpayers' money be spent in this way, so on and so forth. So that would be the final piece, is just to get as much of it privately funded as we possibly could.
Well, yeah, I think the plan would have to be put together and put in front of them. And,
yeah,
you know, that tends to be how it goes. What's that?
I'm currently working on actually putting the plan out.
I've got the rough draft finished. The world is waiting.
It is waiting, yes. I'm slacking off over here.
Michael Leibowitz, thank you, sir. I'm glad we did this early segment so people can get to know you a little bit. If you listen in after 6, we often have interviews with Michael. He's a prisoner in the state system. All right, Leibowitz, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, Todd. Thanks a lot.